Welcome to the myelofibrosis edition of Rare Disease Advisor's Rare Care Podcast, offering unique perspectives from researchers, clinicians, and influencers from the MF community.
Hello, and welcome to the Rare Care Podcast. This is your host, Larry Luxner, Senior Correspondent for Rare Disease Advisor. We're at the SOHO 2025 conference in Houston, Texas, and our guest today is Dr. John Mascareñas, Professor of Medicine at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
So we're here to talk today about myelofibrosis. It's, of course, a rare disease, one that we write about frequently, but we don't often have the opportunity to speak to somebody like you who is such an expert in the field. Can you talk a bit about the disease, please?
Sure. So I think the first thing to point out that myelofibrosis is indeed a rare disease. The incidence is probably somewhere around one person, new diagnosis per 100,000. It is often diagnosed in patients 60 to 65 years of age, but we see patients even in their 20s diagnosed. I'm not clear that there's really any ethnic prevalence of this disease, although we do know that there are certain risk factors. For example, exposures to radiation or benzenes, for example, are likely contributing to higher rates of myeloid malignancies, including myelofibrosis, for example, in people that were exposed to the World Trade Center catastrophe, or many years ago, people surrounding the areas of Hiroshima, Nagasaki, or even Chernobyl. I see a large group of patients, mostly of Ashkenazi Jewish descent from Eastern Europe, from the Chernobyl area, that have migrated to Brooklyn. And now I see many of them as patients that have myelofibrosis and related diseases. So we do have some understanding of some environmental impact, but for most patients, we don't know why they've developed this hematologic stem cell originating malignancy.
Incredible. So what you just mentioned, I've never heard. This Eastern European origin, this is not associated with other types of diseases such as Gaucher that are also seen in that same population. You're saying this is more of an environmental
factor? Probably more of environmental because of exposures, particularly surrounding Chernobyl. Although there is some data that would suggest that there are certain patient populations where maybe the incidence is higher, example, Ashkenazi Jews. But you know, a lot of that's not quite clear. And the fact is you can see these diagnoses in any patient population. I have seen some data that would suggest in the US the prevalence and incidence may be higher than in certain parts of Europe. But I think that a lot of it is complicated in rare diseases by capturing the data. And I think that's the hardest part.
So basically, myelofibrosis is scarring of the bone marrow. It's fibrosis in the blood.
So it's a name that I unfortunately think does the disease a disservice, because myelofibrosis is literally bone marrow scarring or tissue scarring in the bone marrow. But many different diseases can actually result with myelofibrosis or bone marrow fibrosis. So non-malignant diseases like infectious etiologies, autoimmune complications like lupus and rheumatoid arthritis, tuberculosis in the bone marrow, and then other malignancies like myeloma or lymphoma or leukemia or MDS, when in the bone marrow, can instigate fibrosis or scarring, which is an inflammatory complication. So myelofibrosis, the term doesn't really capture the essence of this rare disease. It is really a hematologic malignancy, a stem cell-derived clonal disease of stem cells in which fibrosis is part of the phenomena of the disease. But it's really a chronic leukemia, actually. And we tend to, I think, downplay the fact or not highlight the fact that myelofibrosis is a chronic leukemia with the potential to get worse and accelerate it into an acute leukemia.
So it is considered a cancer?
Yes.
Okay, because in your presentation, you mentioned that, like, in fact, it is downplayed in that you think that it should be taken far more seriously.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the World Health Organization, as well as the FDA, recognize that, the NCI, by changing, and words matter, by changing the term disorder, myelofibrosis as a myeloproliferative disorder, to neoplasm, to reflect the malignant nature of the disease. These are myeloproliferative neoplasms in which myelofibrosis is one of them, are cancers of the hematopoietic stem and progenitor cells in which you have acquired mutations that provide them with all the properties and fundamentals of cancer.
So you mentioned that in about one out of five cases, it does progress to leukemia, correct?
Correct. So Myelofibrosis is a chronic leukemia, can progress and evolve into usually acute myeloid leukemia, an acute leukemia, which has a very poor prognosis. If I were to say that the MF prognosis is median, is somewhere between 5 to 6 years as a median overall survival, when it transforms to AML, a secondary AML, or what we often call myeloproliferative neoplasm blast phase, the median survival is measured on the order of months, 3 to 5 months.
Yeah, you did mention that. So could we talk a bit about diagnosing the disease? What are the first symptoms usually seen, and how long does it generally take to diagnose myelofibrosis?
So one of the challenges of treating myelofibrosis is that no two patients look alike. They can really present in different ways with different symptomatology: fevers, night sweats, weight loss, cachexia, spleen-related complaints from organomegaly, so early satiety, spleen pain, so abdominal pain, sometimes referred to the left shoulder, bone pains of the long bones, muscle cramping, profound fatigue and weakness and inactivity, something called aquagenic pruritus, which is when water touches you, you start to itch insanely.
I'm sorry, again, what is that called?
Aquagenic pruritus, or water-induced itching, which is really an interesting phenomena that you almost don't see in any other disease but these MPNs, particularly polycythemia vera, which can be an antecedent, a pre-disease to myelofibrosis. And patients can literally have such bad itching that they can't shower or bathe themselves normally because it's so intensely painful and disturbing.
Wow, incredible. I've never even heard of this symptom. Incredible. And you're saying almost no other disease produces this symptom?
Not like this. I'm not aware of any disease really where you get aquagenic pruritus like you do in the myeloproliferative neoplasms. It's most notable in polycythemia vera, a cousin of myelofibrosis, or a disease that can evolve to myelofibrosis, but you can see it in any of the MPN. So it's one of the unusual symptoms. Otherwise, I would argue that the myelofibrosis symptoms are quite protean. They could be any type of disease: fatigue, weight loss. I mean, they're classic cancer symptoms, actually, fevers. And then there are symptoms that could be mistaken for lymphoma, like you can have lymphadenopathy, you can have a big spleen, and that can cause symptoms. I think probably, and today we talked about it at our symposium, probably the most irritating symptom to patients, most frequent and severe, is fatigue. And I stress that because it's a fatigue that most people who don't have the disease can't totally appreciate. It's a debilitating fatigue where people can literally not complete activities, sometimes of daily living, and their lives become quite small and quite narrow because they can't engage in normal social and work-related activities.
You said somebody can't get off the couch,
yep,
for example.
Yep.
Would you step back a bit and tell us a little bit about your own background?
Sure.
as a physician and how you came to this particular field?
So I was interested in laboratory research initially, so in high school and then college and into medical school. I was involved in laboratory research in leukemias, and trying to understand the behavior of leukemia cells in the lab and how immunologic aspects of the disease can be exploited for therapeutic benefit. And then that took me ultimately into, in residency and then into fellowship, into this very specific and somewhat narrow subspecialty of these types of chronic leukemias, the myeloproliferative neoplasms. I don't do laboratory research at this point, and I've really built a career over the last 20 years of translational research, trying to take insights from my colleagues in the lab and rapidly translate them into therapeutic benefits. So I have the good fortune of being there right from the beginning with the advent and evaluation of all of the JAK inhibitors. I've led some of those phase 3 studies that have gotten approval, and many other therapies that are currently in approval, and many therapies that have failed to hit their endpoints. So I've had an exciting opportunity to be involved in this.
You're a New Yorker, right?
Yep.
So you mentioned something fascinating for me about the prevalence of this particular disease among survivors of the World Trade Center disaster.
So we and others have been collecting data on the health-related complications of people, whether they were first responders or people who lived downtown Manhattan area that were exposed to the dust and the soot and the smoke from the towers, realizing that there were going to be health impacts over the long run. But I think most people were focused on lung-related injuries and stuff like that. What we are seeing is that there's a higher incidence of what's called CHIP, clonal hematopoiesis of indeterminate potential. And CHIP is when you start to see mutations in the blood cells of people at a higher rate than you would expect that were exposed, in this case, to the World Trade Center. And these mutations are the same mutations that are associated with blood cancers. And they are the pre-cancer form that has not yet become the obvious clinical manifestation of a blood cancer. And some of those mutations can be JAK2 mutation, which is prevalent in myelofibrosis and related MPNs. And acute myeloid leukemias.
I want to get to the mutations just in a bit. How many of these patients have you personally treated?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know if I know the number, because some of them come through what's called the World Trade Center program specifically, and others have come through other avenues, but I have recognized we're exposed to World Trade Center. So I don't know that I know the number, but it's dozens at this point.
Let's talk about these specific mutations that lead to myelofibrosis. For example, you said the JAK2 gene.
I would say that there are three main mutations that drive the signaling pathway that's upregulated in myelofibrosis. So there's the JAK2 V617F mutation, that's in exon 14 of this gene called JAK2. There's a CALR exon 9 mutation in a gene called calreticulin. And then a mutation in MPL515L or K. These are genes that code for proteins that are important either upstream or downstream in a signaling cascade called the JAK-STAT signaling pathway. And the JAK-STAT signaling pathway is an important signaling pathway that we all have that governs the production of blood cells and the production of inflammatory molecules. But it is deregulated in these diseases because 90% of patients with myelofibrosis, for example, will have one of these driver mutations that activate this pathway. So the central unifying theme biologically of myelofibrosis and the MPNs in general is this activated JAK-STAT signaling pathway. Because the knowledge of that was discerned by five independent labs in 2005, that led to the emergence and the development of JAK inhibitors.
You said that the majority of your patients are over 60, although you have seen people as young as 20 with the disease. So obviously, advancing age is a major risk factor here.
Yep.
Are there any other specific risk factors that are not related to ethnicity?
So I think that we have an incomplete understanding of it. We know that as you look at people in older age groups, they tend to have these mutations like JAK2 that are just in their blood cells, and we don't know why. But there is data that would suggest from the UK that those mutations were acquired decades before clinical manifestations. So we are beginning to change at least I'm changing my viewpoint. I used to believe that patients who were diagnosed with myelofibrosis probably acquired the mutation a year or two before the disease. And now the science tells us that that's probably wrong, that they probably developed the mutation when they were 5 years old or even in utero, but it takes many years for the acquisition of other alterations in the cells to allow that specific stem cell then to become inappropriate and aberrant in its activity. But if you were to ask me, like, if you have a family of four in the New York City metropolitan area, and one sibling has the disease, and they drank the same water, ate the same food, had the same parents, why do the other three people don't have it? We don't know. But I'll tell you an interesting fact that is well described, is people who have a first degree relative with an MPN are much more likely to become an MPN patient than people who don't. So there is a clear inheritance risk associated with it. So you don't inherit the mutation, but you inherit the predisposition to acquiring the mutation.
Don't know why. Is this anything, for example, like the BRCA mutation in breast cancer?
So it could be. I don't think we understand exactly what are the determinants for that, but we do recognize that there is an increased predisposition to acquiring these mutations. There's something fundamental probably in the genome of people who get these diseases that predispose them. We know that there are probably tons of people who never get this, or they might get the mutation, but it never leads to a disease. And if we could understand why, was it immunologic failure? The immune system is supposed to survey, find, and kill malignant cells. Is it failing in some patients? That's been an interest in laboratory science.
Yeah. Well, in the time we have left, I'd just like to discuss some therapies. Obviously, some work better than others. Can we just survey the landscape of
Sure.
therapies quickly?
Sure. So right now, the therapies that we apply for myelofibrosis are unfortunately not remitting therapies. I just want to make that point. The only therapy that we have, which is the ultimate therapy for the potential for cure, is a hematopoietic stem cell transplant, a bone marrow transplant. It's the only therapy we have right now that can cure a patient with myelofibrosis, but at a risk of morbidity and mortality. So that's a therapy that I think is probably underutilized or underappreciated that should be explored with every patient with myelofibrosis.
But also the risk goes up the older a patient is.
Absolutely. So it's a balancing act. And that's why it really should only be done in certain centers that have a lot of experience with transplanting myelofibrosis patients. And the reality is it's may not be applicable for a lot of patients because of advanced age or competing comorbidities. But transplant is the only curative option that we have. The JAK inhibitors are a fantastic addition to our armamentarium. Since about 2007, ruxolitinib, the first approved one in 2011, fedratinib in 2019, pacritinib in 2022, and then momelotinib in 2023 are four JAK inhibitors. So they are drugs that target this JAK-STAT signaling pathway, irrespective of the mutation you have, whether it's JAK2, CALR, or MPL, or triple negative, you don't have any of those.
But they also carry their own risk.
Absolutely. So, you know, it's like most things in life, like my dad said, like nothing ever comes for free. There's always a potential cost. And sometimes the cost is toxicity. I would say that the benefit of most of these drugs will outweigh the risk associated with them. But you really need to understand how to tailor and personalize the approach, because there are nuances to which drugs might work best in which patient population. I just want to paint a picture for those listeners of one that I think is genuinely bright in this disease, because there's so many bright people, both in the laboratory and the clinic, that are trying to develop rational therapies. The era of just throwing things at a dartboard, hoping they will work, is done. This is a very scientifically driven and collaborative era that really takes the collaboration of many investigators from the US to Europe to Israel to all over Asia. So it's really a group effort to really get to a point where we can have true disease-modifying drugs and offer cures outside of transplant.
Wonderful. We've been speaking with Dr. John Mascarenhas, Professor of Medicine at the Icahn School of Medicine in Mount Sinai in New York. This is Larry Luxner, Senior Correspondent for Rare Disease Advisor. Thank you so much for listening.
Be sure to follow the latest news, perspectives, and clinical resources on rare diseases at rarediseaseadvisor.com. Thank you for listening.